So, Richard, I know you love Armin Shimmerman a lot, and we finally get a Quark episode.
I really liked this episode. I had a good time with this episode.
I'm glad one of us did.
Hey, you know, they've taken Ferengi into about as opposite of direction as they were when they initially started, and I'm very happy about that. There are no blue whips anymore. There haven't been for a while, and I think it's nice getting a little glimpse into what Ferengi culture actually is.
I mean, I guess, but I don't know. My problem with the Negus is a couple things. Number one, I don't really like mafia stuff. I don't really like The Godfather. I'm not interested in it. And I know that's my own personal bias, and I should not criticize an episode for doing that. I think it's an effective Godfather parody, or homage, not a parody. But, I have a problem getting past that. And then also, I just don't really get a good sense of who the Negus is or what he's actually in charge of.
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear whether, you know, is he the only Negus? Are there a lot of Negi?
Well, I would assume by calling him the Grand Negus that he is the only one.
Yeah, but, they could also think about calling him the President, you know. Just, you know, there are people that, you know, if I refer to the President, you know, I mean of the United States, but that also, we know that there are other presidents in the world, you know. If it could be that these are...
No, there aren't. Only America has a president.
Only America has an effective president, but that's a different story. I got the sense that there is some kind of coalition, whether this is a business concern or whether this is countries, you know. Ferengi seems like it would be, you know, a... made up of competing corporations in a way. Like, I would assume that that's more how their society is formed. And so he is the head of whatever corporation that Quark is a member of. That was the assumption that I got from it. At least that's as much as the episode needs you to think about it.
I don't really, I don't buy that, because the episode wants us to think that these things are extremely important and sort of have a lot of, you know, important resonances and sort of consequences, you know, throughout the Gamma Quadrant and Ferengi society. And so, you know, it's no big spoiler to say that later on the Grand Negus is basically revealed to be like the leader of the Ferengi Empire or whatever you want to call it. I mean, he is like the political leader. It's never clear, like, if this is hereditary. It's never clear how you actually become the Grand Negus. Is this an elected position? It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, it seems an appointed position almost.
Right, and so that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So I just don't get a good sense in this episode that they knew what the Grand Negus was or what it was supposed to represent, really.
And that is very fair.
Yeah, and then I think so it kind of leaves the rest of the episode flat, because you don't know how seriously to take any of this stuff. Like, Quark becoming the Grand Negus, what does that mean? I don't know. And so it's a problem for the episode, because it's trying to lend some importance to these events, and the episode doesn't sell the importance.
See, the thing is, for me, I was able to I wasn't quite able to understand what these events meant for the Gamma Quadrant, for Deep Space Nine, for the Ferengi, for the Federal, you know. It was very clear what these events meant for Quark. And from that perspective, I found the episode was effective. Because, again, if I didn't – because you know that there were – to a very real degree, this was a very predictable episode. I wasn't surprised by a single one of the twists. I didn't find that mattered. Again, this was more of a comedy episode in a lot of ways. And, you know, if what's exactly happening So you know from the beginning, once Quark is appointed Grand Negus, he's not going to be the Grand Negus at the end of the episode. Like, they're not going to make that change right away. So in a way, it's more of a device to get Quark in a very paranoid situation where everybody's trying to kill him and he doesn't know who to trust. And again, I found that because the stakes of this episode kind of were undermined by a lot of things within it, by a lot of the structure, by the fact that it was very obvious this wasn't going to be any permanent changes, but that helped it to work as a comedy episode in some ways. Because
I suppose so, but I think that one of the things that doesn't work for me in this episode is the comedy. I don't find it very funny. And so, you know, I like Wallace Shawn, for example. I think that he's a fantastic, you know, character actor. But I don't like the character of the Grand Nagus. I just find him annoying. And
I mean, he does have that voice.
Well, yeah. And it's not even the voice. It's just I don't know. I don't find the Ferengi interesting. And I don't find I don't find the stereotypical Ferengi to be interesting. You know, I find Quark to be interesting because he is a fully realized character. And as much as we've seen any character on Deep Space Nine be fully realized at this point in the series.
Yeah.
We kind of get a sense of who he is. We get a sense of his values. We get a sense of what he believes. And the Ferengi just to me, you know, they've gone from being what they were in the first season of The Next Generation, which was, you know, unintentionally comic villains or unintentionally comic foes, to being intentionally comic what? I don't know. And I think that it's interesting that, you know, I want to talk about Sisko and Jake and Nog because I think that plot is much more interesting. But and in terms of structure, I think that the show is doing a much better job of integrating A and B plots into its structure it does them than TNG ever did. But I think that one of my problems with the Ferengi is that they seem to think that they're capitalists and everyone else seems to think that they're capitalists, and they're not capitalists.
What are they?
Well, they're mercantilists. I mean, you know, what you have in essence is you have a government which is doling out economic favors in exchange for a cut of the profits. That's not really capitalism. And so, you know, when people are coming to Grand Nagus Quark in the episode and asking for the permission to, you know, give Synthahol to the Gamma Quadrant or whatever, that's not capitalism. And so, you know, it's just weird to me that that everyone in the show kind of just assumes that these are kind of sort of like objectivist Ayn Randian capitalists, and they're just not. I mean, there's a lot of protectionism in Ferengi society, and there's a lot of government interference in the economy.
But,
and
you know, so, I want to say that seems almost more like a criticism of the fandom than it does of the episode, because the episode – nobody in the episode says, oh, my God, those Ferengi, they're so capitalist. Like, they just portray what a Ferengi business meeting is, you know, and without labeling it. They say that's, you know, it's pretty much what the Ferengi's doing. So, yeah, that sounds like a – you know, people are mistakenly interpreting this, but, you know, maybe intended to be a mercantilist society.
I guess that's a fair point, but I don't really get a sense that and I bring this up because I don't really get a sense that the writers really thought this out other than they were just greedy capitalists. And that's what it seems like to me, you know, and so it's a problem because I don't know that Ferengi society is all that well thought out at this point. And I don't think that it ever really is well thought out.
Well, I guess to me what the episode felt very well organized in that for me the key to this episode was this essay on ethics that Nog is told to write at the beginning of it that he doesn't have in and that he lies, you know, and that's a very obvious thing, you know, and I guess this episode is a discussion of what ethics are to the Ferengi. And in a way, this is making clear a few of the things that are the baseline of what a stereotypical Ferengi is. Because remember, at this point, we really haven't seen that much in the way of stereotypical Ferengi. We've seen, again, the whip guys from the very early season, which are pretty much swept under the rug at this point. We've seen what's-his-name who has it in for Picard and is seen as an aberration. And we see Quark, who's a much more realized character. I mean, so far, in Deep Space Nine, all of our experience with the Ferengi has been through Quark and his brother for the most part. And so, to a degree, I think this is showing what the baseline of Ferengi culture is. They do need to establish that, and this is as fine a time as any to do that.
Well, yeah, I guess.
The whole thing is I'm a newbie to this. So as a newbie, I liked this episode because it was answering a bunch of questions about how because what I think is very interesting is that we see, you know, to everybody else on Deep Space Nine, everyone thinks that what the Ferengi do is horrible. They think that they're, you know, they're trying to get Nog into school to essentially civilize him is really what's happening there. They think that they're crooks. They think that, you know, and yet we see that Ferengi society does have its regiments in its way. It does run through a series of ethics, even though we think that those ethics are fucked up. I mean, this is a society that is based around the profit motive that literally has as the ethically right thing to do. You should screw your brother over if you are, you know, if you get the chance to make a profit out of it. You know, again, we see Quark proud of his brother at the end for trying to do that because, in a way, his brother has finally stepped up and done the right thing. And I guess I liked the episode in that way because it is kind of, I mean, that's how the comedy worked for this. It is, in a way, a comedy of manners. We see a Ferengi society as one in which values are kind of turned upside down in a lot of ways.
I mean, I think that's all true, but
whether you like that or not, yeah.
Well, yeah, and I'm trying to see it from your perspective because, of course, I'm informed by everything that comes after this. And, you know, there are a lot of Ferengi episodes, and I don't think a lot of them work very well. You know, I don't find them very interesting. And,
okay.
You know, and I just don't find the Ferengi very interesting because I think that when we have a Ferengi episode, you know, my problem with it is really that, you know, we have Quark, who, again, is a dynamic, interesting character with a lot of facets. And then as soon as a Ferengi episode comes around, we're watching a cartoon. And I don't, you know, that's not interesting to me.
You know, again, it has the very sitcom device of somebody getting a bit of power and it totally going to their head and they going, you know, again, cartoon. Yeah, that's not a bad way to put it.
And I guess I don't watch Deep Space Nine for a cartoon.
And that's very fair. Maybe we're not, but you know, and I can see this as being not quite sure how the, cause this is again, one of the more episodic, you know, episodes. This does very, again, not that we've seen a lot going into the meta plot of Deep Space Nine, but this is even further removed from that.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I think that they do try. I mean, let's talk about the B plot because I think the B plot is interesting. And what I like about it is that this is the part of the episode that actually takes the Ferengi seriously as a culture because,
yes.
You know, Jake and Nog are having their difficulties or whatever you want to call them. And Nog obviously is being brought up in a very different, you know, moral tradition than Jake is. And his father realizes that, but I think his father realizes that he doesn't want to necessarily get in the way of that relationship because that's just, he's not going to win there, as he says to Dax.
Yeah.
And also, by the way, I love that Dax just stays when he leaves and eats the stew, which is fantastic.
No, I love that. You know, number one, she recognizes exactly what it is. You know, he made his famous aubergine stew, you know, which was mentioned in the pilot. That was how he picked up his, you know, the woman who became his wife, you know. And Dax has had this meal so many times, you know, I like that familiarity, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
she's,
I do too.
You know, she does still have to a degree, you know, their houses are each other's houses. You know, that was a nice moment.
Yeah, I like that. But you know, what the scene that really stands out for me is when Sisko very, you know, sort of he's very clear and he's very specific when he says, look, Ferengi values are just very different and we've never been able to forge a common bond.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a good way to approach the episode. And maybe that's a good way to approach Ferengi episodes in general, because it's kind of a meta statement on Ferengi episodes on Deep Space Nine, where, you know, once a season or twice a season or whatever it is, you know, we're going to get, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say that we're going to get a Ferengi episode
yeah.
every couple
oh,
of
yeah.
seasons, that, you know, we're just going to get a very different, we're going to get a very different moral structure and and it's going to be treated as comedy because we're looking at a different moral perspective than we're used to, but we don't necessarily need to take it seriously because nobody else is in this. And that's kind of an interesting way to look at it, I think, but I'm not sure.
See, to me, I almost wonder, like, there is a degree to where I wonder how the Federation views the Ferengi just on the level of Sisko can't be tempted by money because he has a replicator. Do you know what I mean? Like, there
yeah.
is, you know, this is a society that's based on profit when you have a post-scarcity society. I think in a way that's kind of where part of my interest in the Ferengi comes, because they have all of this business concern, but is there really any reason for it? Why do they still need to, you know, they are greed in its purest form, given that it doesn't have any actual, like I said, there, what gold pressed latinum just seems to be a MacGuffin currency in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, sure. And I think that's a good point, but I wonder if we can turn that around on its head and say, in the same way that the Ferengi are greedy with no real reason anymore. They want profit, even though they apparently have replicators and they apparently have all of the technology that the Federation has. Why, you know, now that the Federation exists and Earth is a paradise, why do humans still want to go out and explore? What is the reason for that?
I mean, no, it's there is a degree to which it's, you know, we got to kill some time before we die to a degree. And if
so, this is the way that the Ferengi are killing time before they die.
No, and I to a degree, yeah, it's, you know, it's almost like, you know, what we saw from the game episode a couple episodes ago, where playing games is what they do. You know, they just really like to play games. That's in a way what the Ferengi are. Now, this the game that they play happens to be, you know, galactic, you know, finance. But it is, you know, they enjoy the acquisition. They enjoy power games. And
yeah,
that's what's happening.
Well, I suppose that's true. And I think that the one problem with the Ferengi is that, you know, while this is how they're passing time before they die, they're also hurting a lot of people in the process.
Well, and, yeah.
You know, and I'm not really sure how a society like this could function. And I guess
that's the thing with, you know, one of the things about mafia stories is that, you know, you know, there's always this, you know, it's one thing to, you know, to kill Luca Brasi because, you know, well, he's within the mafia, you know, they're all, you know, everyone in a way kind of consents to that kind of lifestyle. But it's when a civilian gets hurt that's a problem. You know, the entire plot of The Wire is started by somebody who's not part of the drug gang getting killed.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one they have to take very seriously. So,
well, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's one thing if the Ferengi have competing business concerns and, you know, the Ferengi are, you know, doing all this horrible shit to each other, you know, that's one thing. But, you know, as I said, you know, people come into Quarks to gamble. You know, you're going to get screwed out of some money if you go into Quarks, but, you know, you see that as the price of admission.
But I also think that, you know, and I don't want to give any spoilers about what we find out about Ferengi society in future episodes. But, you know, I don't think it's going to be a shock to you to say that there are elements of Ferengi society that are disenfranchised and not happy. Right. And I think.
Yeah. I'm really interested to see where they go with Ferengi women because we haven't seen a one, and there's been, you know, they've made suggestions about, you know, definitely they are much, much lower class, you know, but it's unclear to the degree to which they're, you know, I'm honestly not clear whether, you know, females and, you know, Ferengi females are completely sentient. Like, I'm thinking almost, if you remember Perdido Street Station, where, you know, the males in Khepri society are bugs and the females have intelligence. Like, I don't know if it's that. I don't know if they've just en masse, you know, completely oppressed women. And, you know, I don't know.
Yes.
That's going to be interesting to see. Okay.
I mean, you know, I take your point, and I think it's an interesting interpretation to think that perhaps the Ferengi women aren't entirely sentient. But
well,
I think
at this point, they haven't made it clear.
Yeah,
it could go either way.
But I think it's interesting that you're kind of having that interpretation, though, or you think that's a possibility, because, of course, I don't think that's something that's a little dark for Star Trek. And
oh yeah.
And so,
but I also I still don't know quite how dark Deep Space Nine will go.
Right.
Because I've been told it does get much darker than it is now. Already I've seen it go into some territory that, you know, TNG wasn't quite ready to do.
Yeah.
I know that some episodes of TNG got fairly dark towards the end. And so I guess to a degree, it does seem, you know, kind of dark for where it's been so far, it's not so horrible that, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I see what you mean. So let's talk about Quark then, because we haven't really talked about him in this episode. We've sort of elided a lot of that. And I think that, you know, what do you make of Quark's sort of transformation in this episode, and then the way that he handles going into being the Grand Nagus and then going back to being just plain old Quark?
You know, like, I actually found Quark one of the less interesting parts of this episode, but, you know, I mean, of course, Quark will let power go to his head, and he won't question why he's been given this power. Like, I thought out of everything, that was the most Quark. Like,
Yeah.
The second, you know, once the grand, you know, Negus announces that Quark is going to be his successor, while it's not 100%, like, I thought that he was, you know, doing this stratagem to root out some enemies, you know, that he did it as a test for his son, you know, wasn't completely shocking, but was, you know, but either way, it's very obvious the Grand Negus isn't really dead, that he's, you know, doing this for some kind of, you know, grand strategy reason, and that, frankly, he's using Quark. I mean, Quark is, you know, he's a good bartender in Deep Space Nine, but he's not a major player in, you know, the Negus's world. You know, he doesn't really rub shoulders with, you know, these other people. Frankly, when there's the meeting, he's ready to scurry out because, you know, he's just the bartender. And when he's told to stay, he sits in the corner, you know, and, you know, does, you know, is quote unquote not there. You know what I mean? So, but once Quark is, you know, named as the Negus, he doesn't question any of that. You know, he just assumes he's being given his due. And, you know, yeah, well, I of course I'd be, you know, named as the Grand Negus next. Why not, you know? And I think that's kind of one of the more, like I said, it is kind of a sitcom-y plot. Somebody yeah. gets, you know, power and it goes to their head and they go crazy. But, you know,
Well, I think that's a good, actually, I think that's a clarifies something for me, because I think one of the reasons why I don't really like this episode is that it's a very, very early version of a Ferengi episode. And I do think that while I'm not the hugest fan of Ferengi episodes, they do get a bit more complex later.
Okay.
And I think that this is, like I said, this is very cartoonish, almost to an absurd degree.
Yeah, no, I definitely can see that. Again, it's interesting that we do seem to have different opinions of this episode based on the fact that you know where Ferengi go.
Yeah, and it's just, I'm surprised that you like it so much because, you know, Deep Space Nine so far, I think, has shown a bit more moral complexity and a bit more complexity in its storytelling and its character work. And so this almost seems like a step back. And I'm surprised that you like it so much.
Well, I mean, it's probably not going to be on my top five episodes list or anything, even if we're just doing the first season. But,
true.
You know, I saw this on Thursday night after, you know, a somewhat rotten day, and it was, you know, kind of fun to watch. So I guess, you know, for that reason, was it a great episode? No. Was it an entertaining episode that I enjoyed? Yeah.
Okay, that's fair. I can understand that impulse. So I think the last thing I want to mention before we move on to talking about the Vortex, or is it just Vortex? I forget.
Who knows?
Is the rules of acquisition, which I don't think from your blank expression that you're even remembering what
they're just like, you know, it's like their 10 commandments. I mean, they like quote it once or twice.
So the rules of acquisition in this episode, this is the first appearance of the rules of acquisition, and they are kind of what has guided Ferengi society. They are not just the 10 commandments. They are sort of like a list of, I don't know, they have like 150 of them or something.
Yeah.
And this is basically how Ferengi society has been constructed. So do with that information.
I mean, they all seem to be based. Again, this is where the principle of, you know, you can screw over your brother for profit, that's the right thing to do, comes from. Again, this is I get the sense it's the Ferengi code of ethics. You know, it's their.
Yeah. That's kind of what it is. It's kind of the Ferengi code of ethics and the Ferengi constitution all rolled into one to some degree.
Well, they seem to have government, religion, and money seem to be the same thing to all of them.
Yeah, that's very true.
So they don't really have a difference between that. One final point. Keiko's a bad teacher. Because
why?
Nog doesn't know how to read, and yet Jake's able to show him fairly quickly.
Yeah, and how could he write an essay if he couldn't read?
I know. Like, there is...
Oh,
like,
well, I guess...
Like, it's one thing if you know, Miles doesn't quite know that. You know, obviously, he's just trying not to get, you know, paper thrown at him. That's fine. But
yeah, Miles is just there. He's just kind of like, I need to get through this shit.
He's the glorified babysitter. Yeah.
Miles is working 16-hour days while Keiko was gone.
I know. Like, why is he the one who's doing school in the meantime? Like, it's not like.
Listen, Richard, Keiko, a botanist with no educational training, is the school teacher. So why would you think that there's someone more qualified to be a substitute than Miles O'Brien?
But, well, I mean, it's the fact that we had, you know, everything, you know, the space station is falling apart still, and Miles O'Brien is the only person who's, like, holding it together.
Hey, give credit where credit's due. It's doing better. It's,
you know,
all right now. The lights are on. The replicators are working. You know,
how do you think Schofield's about this. His head of operations goes, you know, my wife's going on vacation, so I'm going to teach the children, you know?
I think that Sisko's fine with it.
Good for Sisko.
Sisko's a nice man.
And Jake's a nice boy, and they're everybody's nice.
Well, this is the start of something that you know, Nog becomes later on, so I'll just leave that with that.
Oh, God, does Nog end up teaching the school? Because that would be awful.
No, but I don't think you'll be able to guess where Nog's storyline goes. So we'll just leave it there.
Nog has a storyline. I think that's all you need to say.
Nog becomes one of my favorite characters.
Really?
Yes. Let's talk about Vortex.
Let's talk about Vortex, which is an Odo episode.
Yeah, I like this one.
I like this one very much too. I like that I like that they stretch out. They don't really tell us. We get pretty much a name and the fact that there are others of him and they come from the Gamma Quadrant. Like, that's the information we learn from this. Like, I like that they're apparently stretching out this mystery a lot. Like, they're probably going to build up these shapeshifters or changelings or whatever they're going to be called. Like, I think it's interesting they're building them up so much and so slowly.
Yeah, because I think if this had been the Next Generation, I think that we would have gotten a reveal like Data's backstory in one big lump, you know, and then that would have been it.
Yeah.
Whereas with this show, they're kind of taking the long game, as you say, and they're kind of just doling out information as much as possible, you know, as little as possible and as slowly as possible.
And I mean,
you know,
it makes the shifters and it makes Odo very, you know, it builds up their mystery, you know, even more. You know, now I'm really curious.
It also kind of paints the Gamma Quadrant as very different from the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah.
Because from the little information that we've gotten about the Gamma Quadrant so far, it doesn't seem as though there are any like big galactic powers like there are in the Alpha Quadrant, right?
No, at this point, if there were an equivalent of the Federation or even the Klingons or hell, even the Ferengi, they would have contacted them by now.
Yeah, and you would say, okay, that, you know, maybe that's just a storytelling device and perhaps I'll get into that later. But, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about the Gamma Quadrant is that there's an implication that the wormhole in both the Alpha and Gamma Quadrants is kind of in the middle of nowhere. And so, you know, in this episode, it's revealed that there aren't that many M-class planets within range of the wormhole. And, you know, obviously it's a huge region of space with millions of planets, but, you know, we don't really have a sense of what the actual environment actually surrounding the wormhole in the Gamma Quadrant is. And so I think one of the reasons why it seems so mysterious and so kind of uncharted right now is frankly because it is.
Yeah.
And they just don't know what's out there and they haven't explored that much.
I mean, this is a place where nobody's been to, right? Like Vash has been there and that's about it.
Yeah, Vash has been there.
A handful of people at this point have been to the Gamma Quadrant and that's about, you know.
Because there was that episode, The Price, in TNG season 3 with the wormhole that actually turned out to not be stable. But I believe that went to the Delta Quadrant. So, no one has really been there before.
Yeah.
And I think that that's kind of a, you know, it's uncharted territory in a literal sense.
And frankly, everybody that we've met from the Gamma Quadrant is really weird and not exactly looking for a long-term relationship with the Federation or anybody. Like,
right.
You know, the one people who seem like they're going to be actually having some kind of continuing relationship were those gaming assholes. Like,
right.
We've had the Hunters. We've had this guy who, you know, is not telling any, you know, has so mysterious. We have the people who are chasing him who are jerks, like, you know, and living in an oppressive prison state. Like, the Gamma Quadrant hasn't really been good so far.
Yeah, and I think that, you know,
everyone talks about how it's going to have unprecedented prosperity as a result of this wormhole. But so far, what has the wormhole done for anyone?
Right. And I think that, you know, there's a very good reason why the alien species from the Gamma Quadrant that we've seen so far have sort of been uninterested in long-term contact with the Federation or anybody else in the Alpha Quadrant. It's a little bit of a retcon, but I think that it works, and I don't want to reveal why, but it does make sense in hindsight once you know what happens later on down the line.
Okay.
I think what's important for this episode is what you said, though, is that the Gamma Quadrant, the alien species from the Gamma Quadrant are frankly kind of assholes and not all that interested in long-term contact with anybody. And so they drop in and drop out. The other thing I think is interesting is that, you know, the changeling stuff is very, very obscure, and we're not sure where that's going to go.
And it's, you know, they're a very interesting, the guy's story is basically that they were hunted and, you know, attacked and, you know, oppressed and everything. And you can see why people would be uncomfortable with beings that can look like they're anything, you know, in terms of infiltration and all of that. But, yeah, they're almost a legend. Nobody, I mean, at this point, yes, we are going to meet other changelings, you know, we're going to find out about them. But as far as Odo knows, they're all dead right at this point. He's the only one left. Like,
yeah,
he hasn't heard anything otherwise.
Yeah, and that guy even says that you know, he says that story about changelings being persecuted, but of course later on in the episode he says that basically that was a myth. Like, that, you know, they're not even sure if that's actually true. And so really what Odo gets out of this episode at the end of it is basically nothing except a little toy necklace.
Yeah, he gets a toy necklace and a name.
Yeah, and we don't even know if the name is what
is that an epithet calls or
So really, he doesn't get anything out of this episode. It kind of makes it more confusing for him in a way.
Well, it's a kind of a tease, you know. He's being told you'll find the answers, you know, you'll find it, you know. Here's where you're going to find your people. And, you know, the trail goes cold, but, you know, it's certainly going to spur him on to try it. Now he's going to ask everybody he meets from the Gamma Quadrant, hey, have you heard of anything called the Changelings? You know, are there any shaped, you know. He's going to, you know, this is really just going to drive his obsession with his own origins.
Yeah, I think so. And one of the things that we've seen about Odo so far, I mean, I'm curious, you know, you like Odo. And so I think that Odo is a really interesting character, especially early on in the show, because he is so distinct from the rest of the cast. And frankly, a lot of the other characters that we've seen in Star Trek. I mean, in a way, Odo is obviously supposed to be the Spock Data stand-in in this show. Because he is unique.
I mean,
he is,
I think,
the outsider.
Dax is too.
I don't know about
not
that.
Quite as much, because Dax is a Federation, you know, person through and through. But I think that
Odo is more of the Data Spock stand-in for a reason, and the reason is that he is kind of unique. He's one of a kind, and he is kind of the outsider. And he,
I guess,
frankly,
I will say that I think that the show doesn't quite map, you know, as well as, you know, to where you can say, you know, in other words, he's not a Data or a Spock. He's an Odo, I think, already. You know, I think that's kind of nice about the show. But anyway.
Yeah, but I think you can make that argument that he's kind of slotting into that scene.
Yeah.
You know, because he has these wry observations about humanoid behavior. And that's kind of similar to how Data used to talk about human behavior. And, you know, that's how Spock used to talk about human behavior. So you know, it's not an exact match.
Yeah,
Again, yeah, I think that's right. That's a good thing. But it does kind of work that way. And so
if they met at a par, if Spock, Odo, and Data were at a party together, they would have a great conversation. You know, they would enjoy each other's company very much.
Yes, although maybe Odo would be a little suspicious of Data, but that's another thing. So, yeah, and then I think that, you know, so what we already know about Odo is all of these things, that he's kind of standoffish. He doesn't really find himself all that interested in humanoid behavior, except as when it's breaking the law. But at the same time, I think he is fascinated by them, and I think he is lonely, you know, and he's someone who doesn't really know how to reach out to people and for whatever reason. And so what we see in this episode is him reaching out for the first time, perhaps. And really, you know, the fact of the matter is he lets that guy go and he lets his daughter go. And that's him. He smiles at the end of the episode. You know, we've never seen Odo smile before. And so he is reaching out for the first time and maybe finding that it's not a bad thing.
Yeah. Like, I think about that one great, you know, little bit he has where he's like, you know, oh, well, you know, dating's all about compromise. You know, you want to watch this thing and she wants to listen to music. You know, you want to listen to this, but she wants to listen to that. So instead of watching the game, you're listening to, you know, music, you know.
Right.
Odo can't, at that point at least, Odo can't really conceive of a relationship where, you know, he can't, you know, in a way, he almost doesn't conceive enough of another person who would want to watch the game with him as opposed to listening to music he doesn't like. You know what I mean?
Right. Odo is a person who sees all the downsides. He's a very glass half empty person.
Yeah. Because he is the only person that he knows like him, in a way, maybe he just doesn't expect that anybody can quite understand him because, you know, really just as he's approximating what a human is, you know, people are only going to be able to approximate what his thought process is in a lot of ways. He doesn't even know what his culture is. You know, he doesn't know what, you know, I'm trying to think of even, you know, just again, he doesn't know what his own culture is. He doesn't know what shapeshifters really eat, what music they listen to, you know, or anything like that. And
right.
Like I said, he's had to build his personality from scratch, but it always feels like, in a way, compromising and pretending he's listening, you know, and having to listen to music he doesn't like is how his personality was made, because he's mimicking humanity.
Well, I wouldn't say he's mimicking humanity.
Well, humanoidness.
Yeah, I'd be very careful about saying that Odo is you know, his form is trying to look human or that he's trying to mimic humanity.
I guess, in that particular case, I'm using human to mean person, so.
Yeah, I think that he sees humanoids. I mean, this is kind of a new concept in Deep Space Nine to a certain degree. You know, that he kind of lumps them all together. You know, and I think that's kind of, you know, I don't want to conflate that with something else, because I think that, you know, number one, Odo isn't trying to look human. He's trying to look like something, you know, but we don't know what. And, you know, we don't know his backstory, but we know that he was head of security when the Cardassians ran the station. And
you know,
so
he
doesn't have a lot of experience with humans yet. And he doesn't have a lot of experience with, you know, some of the other races of the Federation. I mean, this may be the first time that he's really dealing with Trill. This is the first time he's dealing with, you know, all of these races. And so I think it's interesting that Star Trek has been a show that is really about all of these differences in these different alien species. And then here comes Odo, and he's basically like, you're just all humanoids. You all just act the same. You know,
in a way, I almost wonder if his physical form was approached at by, you know, through, in a way, he evolved that form based on the best reactions people had to him. You know what I mean? Like, if you don't have really a true face, you're just gonna try and get the most, you know, attractive but not too attractive, you know, just normal looking. So he, you know, that almost seems like a form that any species is going to come in contact to is going to think is normal in a way.
Yeah, because it looks generic enough.
Yeah, exactly. He has a very generic face. And I mean, like, again, I love how he has that makeup to look very almost plasticky, you know. He's not really creating pores and wrinkles and, you know, all of that stuff. He's just, you know, again, it's a, you know, you and I were asking me the other. This is a great time to go into that conversation we almost had.
Sure. Yeah. So I was sort of wondering, you know, because I'm a creep, if Odo has a penis. Like, does he bother? And you know,
no.
And it's funny because, like, I don't think he does either. I mean,
I think he's a Ken doll down there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, well, frankly, I don't think that. I mean, he doesn't have skin under there. I mean, in essence, his uniform is just part of his body. You know what I mean?
No, so like, that's true.
He's looking like he has a body, but he doesn't really have a body. You know, I mean, I think it's kind of funny that his hair moves. You know, obviously that's just because Renaud Bergeron-Noir has hair. But there's kind of questions about what exactly Odo is able to do and what
he's
capable of.
But if he needed to have sex with somebody, he could fashion a penis or even a vagina or some kind of hybrid, a cloaca, if you will.
Well, that also raises questions about, you know, why Odo is male. You know, why does he present as male? I mean, there's a lot of interesting questions about Odo that we're not really sure, and we don't really know a lot about changelings to know to answer them. You know, I mean,
I think there is a degree to, again, going with whatever, you know, personality is going to be the most effective. Again, especially if we've seen. While the Federation is, you know, has gender equality, even Dr. Crusher, you know, talked about in that episode about how it isn't 100%. We have places like the Ferengi with extreme sexual, you know, dimorphism and all of that. And gender dimorphism.
Yeah.
So in a way, maybe he is picking as a man because that's where he's going to get taken the most seriously as a constable.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point. And you know, it makes me think back to something that the character of the thief said in this episode, where he said something about the changelings don't really take form. Like, that's not their primary means of existence or whatever. And, you know, part of it is like, okay, you have to take that with a grain of salt because the rest of the stuff that he said was a lie. But the part of it is kind of interesting because it's like, yeah, well, you know, how would this alien race evolve and how would they actually present themselves in their natural environment?
We're told that Odo sleeps in a bucket, you know,
right.
When, you know, during the day he needs to be, you know, he can go for like 18 hours, then he has to revert, I think is what they said, or something like that. So he does have a physical, you know, it is some kind of a strain on him, you know, it seems almost like, you know, there is a physical strain that he just needs to sleep it off afterwards. It's like exercising, you know, to a degree. And so I, you know, you do get the sense that changelings just hang around as blobs, you know, for most of the day and only take into a form when they need to. But their society is constructed around knowing that in a way, because he's living in a humanoid society. He has to pretend, you know, because that's the, you know, if he shows up as a blob, he's not going to be able to communicate with everybody. He's going to scare everyone. And he knows that.
Sure, sure. And I think that raises a lot of open questions about how changelings communicate and how, you know, all these kind of things. But I think that these are questions that, you know, whether
but
or not
I like that they but what I think it's great that the series is inviting us to ask all of these questions and pleasantly frustratingly not answering any of them yet.
Yeah, yeah. So we haven't talked a lot about the actual plot of Vortex, and I'm not sure that there's a lot to say.
I think the plot of Vortex.
Yeah, it's kind of just there, and you know, it's fine, and there's a guy that's murdered, and he's a twin, and he wants to kill people, and you've got this guy that's escaping, and you know, it's all fine, but really it's just a vehicle for getting into Odo's
story. And they're from
story.
The Gamma Quadrant too, right?
Yes, they are.
Another fucking weird species.
That's very specious of you, Richard.
I know, but, you know, but here we have another very different, you know, culture thing, which is based on, you know, people, you know, the default mode of being as twins and you think as one unit. Like, that's, you know, again, it's everybody on the – and, yes, that is what Star Trek has always done. And, you know, that's what sci-fi in general does. You have a new species as a quirk, but – you know, compared to what we'd seen before, they're almost going out of their way to make the Gamma Quadrant cultures feel very alien.
Yeah, but I think that's the way to go.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, going back to where there's this, you know, they hunt and they say, you know, you don't have an equivalent in your culture. Like, we've seen a lot of things, a lot of the things in the Gamma Quadrant, there are no equivalents in Alpha Quadrant culture.
Sure. And I think that kind of on a meta level, if we can step back for a minute, I think that that's a good reason for the existence of the show. Because,
oh, yeah. All bets are off.
Why do another Star Trek series if you're not going to do something different? You know, and I think that in effect, that's a large problem with Star Trek Voyager. But we'll talk about that in a year and a half when we get to that show. But yeah, and I think that it's nice that they're making an effort to make the Gamma Quadrant distinctive. And I think that they're also making a real effort to not make the Federation the unmitigated good here. And really giving the opposite side of that and saying, well, all of these alien cultures would have an opinion about Starfleet and the Federation, and it may not be a good one. And they've got their own things going on, and Quark doesn't seem very interested in what's going on with Starfleet and as much as anybody is. And I think the same thing is true for Odo. You know, he doesn't really care who runs the station as long as he's able to do his job effectively.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in a way, that kind of attitude and the fact that Odo is ostensibly, you know, apparently from the Gamma Quadrant, or his species is from the Gamma Quadrant, kind of ties into the way that the show is approaching, you know, alien cultures from that region of the galaxy.
Yeah. I mean, for Odo, like, Kira has finally decided at this point that, you know, the Federation is the best hope. And there's a degree to where Odo is, you know, just as Kira trusts Odo, Odo trusts Kira. And, you know, I think he's going along with her opinion to a degree. He also trusts Sisko at this point. Like, Odo can make connections with individuals. Weird connections. The relationship he has with Quark is weird. You know, we have to admit that. But, he does have these relationships with people and he can connect on an individual level. It's just to a species that he has no alliances to any species, really.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that that's kind of, you know, that may change. We don't
again,
know.
Again, Bajor is the closest he has to someone he has investment in. But again, that's mostly because that's what Kira's investment is. You know, if he, you know, if she didn't feel that way about Bajor, you know, if she didn't feel as passionately, he wouldn't either.
Yeah, very true. And I think that at the end of the day, the choices that these characters are making or the beliefs that these characters are making is just very different from what we've seen in Star Trek before.
Yeah.
And I think that this episode is a perfect encapsulation of that because, in effect, you know, Odo is not doing anything really Star Trek-y in this episode. He is really violating his own code of ethics. He's violating, you know, probably the law in letting this criminal go. And he's really jeopardizing the relationship with this guy's alien species, you know, and
but
so
again,
he doesn't care.
You know, I don't think that Odo can break his code of ethics because to a degree, his code of ethics is very Protean as well. You know, it's very situational. It's very, you know, it's of the moment and of what he thinks is right in that moment. And, you know, which is very, you know, again, Odo always has the ultimate say of what is right in a particular situation. But for somebody who is physically a shapeshifter and who comes from no culture, again, relativism is the moral code that makes the most sense.
Yeah. You just blew my mind.
Yay!
All right. Well, if you would like to share your thoughts on either of the episodes, please do so in the post for this podcast at trekaboutshow.com. Please follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/trekaboutshow. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekaboutshow. And the best way to help the show is to leave us a positive 5-star iTunes review.
Or you could leave a negative 5-star iTunes review. Just give us 5 stars.
Yeah, that would be fine. I don't really care about the review. Just give us 5 stars.
5 stars! There wasn't enough!
So next week, we are continuing into the first season of Deep Space Nine by talking about battle lines and the storyteller.
Well, that's nice.
It is, isn't it? So we'll talk to you next week.